Well, good evening. It's good to see you tonight. We're glad that you are here. If you're visiting with us, we're certainly happy that you have come our way. If you will, open up your New Testaments to Matthew, the 15th chapter, and we're going to talk tonight about an incident that happened in the life of Jesus with an unusual person. The number of encounters in the New Testament with people that are quite unique and are also helpful to us in learning what God wants us to be like. It's a short account. Let's begin reading in chapter 15 at verse 21 down through verse 28. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she is crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly. It is a tremendous passage to me. It is the only occasion that Jesus ever went outside of Jewish territory that we know about, that's recorded. It obviously, I think, foreshadows the gospel going to the whole world. It wasn't just going to be for people that lived in a Jewish environment. It is the beginning of the end of barriers. The Old Testament was passing away. But I want you to notice that if you're using the English Standard or a more modern version that renders it that way, it says of her at verse 22 that she was a Canaanite woman. That is a rare phrase in the New Testament. It appears only here and two times in the book of Acts, both of them in Stephen's recounting of the Old Testament passages that we will be familiar with in the story of the Old Testament. I want you to understand that this woman descended from the Old Testament Canaanites. She descended from the very people God destroyed and cast out of the land of Canaan so that his people could take up residence there. Not because, as he told them, you are more holy in the sense that you are better than they are, but that he had put up with those people as long as his great long-suffering and patience would do so. You remember that he told Abraham the cup of the Amorites' iniquity. The Amorites was another way of referring to all of those nations that we call the Canaanites. He said the cup of the Amorites' iniquity is not yet full. And 400 more years would go by before finally God would bring total destruction upon them. Now, we know things about them that tell us how wicked they were. Archaeologists have found, for instance, in some of the city walls that they have excavated, clay jars that hold the skeletal remains of tiny babies, of infants, that were placed in those walls alive and dedicated to the god when they sealed them there in order to be some kind of honor to their gods. They routinely made their children pass through fire, meaning the god of Molech, something like a sort of a Buddha figure, where they would roll babies down the arms into these pits of fire that were in where the belly of the god would be. And you have accounts in the Old Testament where a Moabite king offers his son in front of an Israelite army, sacrifices his son on the wall to the god Molech that he was worshiping. They routinely practiced just the worst forms of sexual immorality. Both men and women were called priests or priestesses to their gods. They were used the word holy, the very word that God uses of himself and of the priest and all of those that are set apart unto him. They would use that word to describe the most illicit sort of actions that to their gods were meant to be worshipped. On and on the story could go, but can you imagine how degraded that society was? Can you imagine how unbelievably ungodly were the Canaanites? One of the prophets speaks of a man that would go into the same woman that his father had gone into, meaning those religious, terrible religious practices that were performed in honor to those gods. So the Israelites also followed, as God warned them and told them they would do. I want you to understand that that's who she comes from. This is who she has descended from. She should have been destroyed. There should have been no remnant that was left if they had followed the will of God in the Old Testament. But here she is, and she is seeking Jesus. She had a daughter, it says to us at verse 22, who was severely demon-possessed. Tack Chumley in his commentary says, a badly demonized daughter suffering horrors. The woman cried out after him. The Greek has it in imperfect tense. We don't have that tense in our language, but it simply means at a fixed point, it keeps on happening. So that the disciples, you get that point from it, they said, Lord, send her away. She just keeps crying out after us. And though it just tells us that she did this, they are saying it was ongoing, which is exactly what the tense of the verb indicates. She just kept on. She persisted in it. And to the point that it annoyed the disciples so much, they said, get rid of her. Just send her away. I want to tell you, truth can be found where you least expect it. True faith. Rahab the harlot. Naaman the leper. The church at Corinth. It is grace, as J.C. Ryle said, not place, which makes people believers. So let's think for a little bit about this lady and the important lady that she was. Indeed, what she teaches us about having great faith. I want you to know how Jesus reacts to her. The very first thing that he does is to ignore her. Look at verse 23. It says, he answered her not a word. He did not answer at all when she kept crying out after him. Can you imagine what it is when you ignore someone? Kind of like when I'm watching something in sports on TV and my wife has come by and said it two or three times. She doesn't take that well. Ignoring somebody is an insult, isn't it? When they are trying to get your attention, and this woman is pleading with him, can you imagine? He is saying, in effect, you are just not worthy of my response. You're so low down on the scale of things that I don't have any, there's just no consideration that I ought to have towards you. Do you remember when the woman was caught in adultery in John the 8th chapter? And it says that they brought her to Jesus and literally threw her down, thrust her down in the midst of him. That's what the Greek indicates to us. And then they said, we caught this woman in the very act of adultery. The law of Moses says put her to death. What do you say? You remember what Jesus did? It says he knelt down and wrote with his finger in the ground. He didn't say anything to them. Then it says that those guys kept on asking him. Can you imagine the tone? It doesn't tell us the tone of their voice. For can you imagine if somebody ignores you like that, what they began to do toward him? Till finally you know that he said, he rose up and said, you that are without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. And the rest of that story follows a really interesting encounter with Jesus too. But much like this one, the ignoring is an insult to this woman. Then it says to us that he just excludes her. He just simply, when he finally does speak to her, at verse 24, he says this, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And lady, you're not of the house of Israel. You're a Canaanite and therefore a Gentile of the worst sort. You have no claim on me, on my care, upon my time, or upon my power. So now the ultimate insult, the end of the story. There's no legitimacy in you. You have no right to claim anything of me. But the text says she does a remarkable thing. Verse 25 says, the woman worshipped Jesus. Look at verse 25. But she came and knelt before him saying, Lord, help me. I'm going to tell you, she knew something about Jesus. Back up to verse 22. Notice what she calls him. Have mercy on me, O Lord, what? Son of David. How did she know that? She knew something. She knew something about the promises of the Old Testament. She knew that the Messiah was a descendant, would be a descendant of King David. She knew there would be an absolute connection between the Messiah and that ancient one that everyone looked back to, one of the most important figures in the Old Testament, and that he would become like a second David. And so she kneels before him, in essence, I think, is worshiping him and crying out to him, says, Lord, help me. You would think that this would have broken Jesus' heart. To think about her poor daughter and knowing full well what she is undergoing at the hands of Satan being demon-possessed. Do y'all get the commercials out here for St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis? We get them in our area. I'm going to tell you, every time that comes on and there's those little kids and they've suffered so much and they're dealing with cancer and all kinds of terrible diseases, I mean, all I do is I get the checkbook out and the credit card and I say, well, how much do you need? It breaks your heart when you watch a little person suffer so. We're dealing with the person that we think of as what? A master of compassion. A leader in love. The one who sets the bar for all of those most tender things. And yet, he is treating this woman in the coldest and most calculating way to drive her away from him. And we haven't even reached the worst one. Here's the worst one. He says, lady, you're just a dog. That's how low down on the scale you are to me. That is an amazing thing to think about Jesus saying that. She worships him, Lord, help me. And he said, it is not right, much like what Paul said, that the gospel comes to the Jew first, then to the Greek. He said, it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Can you imagine if somebody said that to you? In that day and age, dogs were not usually, though I think here it is, probably somebody that's wealthy. I mean, everybody didn't have a dog at their house, or two or three, like a lot of us. Dogs were scavengers. You remember in the Old Testament, and even in the New Testament, what did they do with Lazarus? They come and lick his sores at the gate. They run around in packs. They eat the carrion that's on the outskirts of town and what people can throw out. They ate the body of Jezebel. Do you remember in the Old Testament? Dogs were not family pets in this culture. Yet, I think, of course, when she says they eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table, she's thinking of a rich household. She's thinking of a family pet. If Jesus means one or the other, it's obvious in his mind he means to denigrate her and make her understand her place in the scheme of things. Sometimes you'll read a commentary and you'll say, well, maybe he was being playful with her like you'd say to a friend, well, you rascal. I don't see that at all. That's not what I get out of this story. In fact, you get everything else but that. There was no twinkle in his eye. There was nothing that was said in that kind of way. In fact, Tack Chumley in his commentary says, by ignoring, excluding, and insulting this desperate mother, Christ never seemed more un-Christ-like. This is not the Jesus that we see in so many other places. So why is he doing this? Verse 27 becomes the answer. She will not let go of him. She is not going to be driven away. She's not going to lose her confidence in what he's able to do for her. She'll not be driven away because she's perplexed by all of this, because she doesn't understand why he's treating her this way. She said, yea, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. And with that, Jesus said, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be so. And her daughter was healed, it says in the English Standard, instantly. And when she got back to her daughter was well. Now, how many of us were persisted with that kind of strength or determination? I'm going to tell you, if somebody had treated me that way, I don't think I would have made it much past one or two. By three, I may have been wanting to throw fist or something else. That's not what you do. A friend of mine in Texas many years ago talked about West Texas, and he preached down in there. And you've got to understand, this is deep, deep West Texas. You're talking down in Big Bend country, that kind of a deal where people still carried pistols. Well, they do anyway, but today. But I mean, they did all the time. It was still the old West. And he said there were a couple of guys that came in that were Army guys, and it was during World War II, or right before it, right in that time period, and they insulted a rancher,
as he came out the door. They said he went to his truck. He got his pistol, went back in, shot both of them. Said they put him before a trial, and everybody out there understood it was the honor. Honor was at stake. They acquitted him because they had offended him. So, I mean, that's what I mean by I wouldn't have made it through number one or two. I would have been absolutely insulted. Would we hold on to Jesus when we just flat don't understand why is he treating my family this way? I have loved him. I've honored him. I've served him. I'm pleading with him in prayer for the health of my little one or whatever the case may be. And we flat do not understand why God treats us this way. I tell you, that's what the Apostle Paul says to us in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 8. Listen to him. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. You understand what he's thinking about there? He's thinking about olives that they would put the rocks on. They still do that in some places. They put the olives in something like a burlap bag, and then rocks are put on it, heavier and heavier and heavier, to just squeeze out, crush the juice out. The oil out. We are afflicted in every way, yet not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. You ever been perplexed by God? I'm going to tell you, you're not going to live long in this life. You're going to be absolutely perplexed by what happens to you in life. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Do you understand what he's saying? Even if you're killed, you're not destroyed. How easily do all of us let discouragement destroy us? Have you ever watched somebody be destroyed by it? Give up on God because they just can't take it anymore, the bad stuff that has happened to them. When I was in high school, I had to read Elie Wiesel's book, Night. You may not know about him, but he was an Auschwitz survivor, and he was a Jew. His family, sister, him, his mother, his father were taken. When they were unloaded from the cattle cars at Auschwitz, his mother and sister went off, and that was the last he ever saw them. They died in that place. His father died in his arms. And the book is about, a very, very short book, but it's about how he lost his faith and how he regained it in God. But there's a story that's told in that book where there was a boy that, because they were starving, had stolen food, and so they had caught him. And the Nazis brought him out, the guards did, into the center of the camp, and they assembled everybody out there. And then they hung that boy, and it took him 30 minutes to die. And while they were having forced to watch that, somebody in the back of where Elie Wiesel was, and this was what caused him to lose his confidence in God. They said, "Where is God? Where is he now?" Have you ever asked that? Have you ever wondered where God is in the midst of your crisis, in the midst of those that you love? Why would Paul say to us in Galatians 6, 9, "And let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap, if we do not give up." If it were not that we are so prevalent to do that we are so likely to give up, because it just gets too hard to trust him anymore. We run away like Elijah. Can you imagine Elijah coming off that just humongous success at Mount Carmel? He outruns, Elijah does, Ahab's chariot, and then rain, you know, is following, finally, breaking that 3.5-year drought. And Jezebel sends word to him and says, "If the gods do so to me, if I don't do so to you, as you did to my prophets by tomorrow at this time." So what does Elijah do? He hightails it. He leaps out and runs until he gets to the southern border of the country, and an angel meets him you know, he's collapsed and wakes him up and feeds him. And on that food, on the strength of that, he's able to go all the way to where Mount Sinai is. And then he's in a cave. And you remember the story. There came a great wind that smashed into that mountain. Can you imagine, have you ever looked at the mountains that are in that area and think about it? Tore, says, chunks out of it. Then an earthquake, fire, probably lightning. And then finally in all of that, there's this stillness, quietness. You don't really know how to translate it. Some say a small voice, but he wraps his mantle across his face and comes out. And God says to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? Do you imagine another scenario? I do. I imagine a scenario where God says, you know, Elijah, I'm so sorry that all this bad stuff has happened to you. I hope you can understand what I'm saying. I'm not trying to be blasphemous. Forgive me for what has happened to you. It's not what happens. He comes out and he says, Elijah, what are you doing here? You imagine Elijah with all the remorse of somebody that just thinks he has given God his all. Says, I only am left. And they seek my life. And God doesn't pat him on the back and he doesn't comfort him in any kind of way. He says, get up and get back. And you anoint Jehu as king over Israel. You anoint the king over Syria. And you anoint Elisha as prophet in your place. And then God just simply says to him, I'll keep count of who's faithful. There are 7,000 knees that have not bowed to Baal. You go do what I commissioned you to do. Okay, the greatest tool in Satan's arsenal is not to get us to commit sexual immorality or extort a bunch of money from somebody or rob somebody from their money that we get from work somehow. We're able to imagine. Most of the time, it's not going to be that causes us to fall. It's simply going to be that we get discouraged with the God that we serve because we just don't see him acting the way we think he ought to act and the way he ought to be toward us. And oh, Satan is also well to fill our minds with reasons to give up and quit, and he knows all too well the poor stuff of which we are made. And he'll hit us again and again until we just simply do give up. There's a second thing that happens in this story that I think is important for us, and that is, how badly do we want God? I realize that I'm talking to a crowd that cares that you're here. The folks that only come on Sunday morning, sometimes I wonder, how badly do you want God? I mean, do you think this is just, that's all there is to it? That you can just show up and somehow Sunday morning's enough? I'm not talking about the fact of us assembling for a gospel meeting or even for Wednesdays and Sunday. All of those things are important. But do you possibly think that if somebody thinks that's the bare minimum I ought to do it, how's their Bible reading going during the week? I doubt very seriously that most of those people read the way they ought to read, or study, or meditate. But you're here tonight. How's ours going? How badly do we want God? Do we love him with all our heart and soul and mind? Do we really understand what that means? I don't think I do. I would not have gone the length that this woman went with Jesus. I don't think I would have. How about you? And yet, when the night is the darkest, it seems like in Scripture that only when it gets as bleak as it can be, that's when God comes. You think of how he leads up the people in the story of the Exodus. And it seems like every time that Pharaoh is about to do the right thing, he makes it worse for them. And now he doesn't give them straw. They've got to go gather their own straw. I mean, even Moses is feeling like, these people are hating me. Why are you treating them this way? Until finally God leads them to the darkest hour, and then He strikes every firstborn of Egypt. It doesn't matter if you were the lowest person in Pharaoh's household or Pharaoh himself. There wasn't a house in Egypt, it says, where there was not one dead. Can you imagine the cry that went up from the land of Egypt? It was probably heard afar, far off. When God comes, it often is at the darkest time. Do you remember this story that's told when he made his disciples get in the boat and go across the Sea of Galilee? And it says in Mark 6:48, and he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was again. He's watching them from the shore. And about the fourth watch of the night, 3 in the morning, he comes to them walking on the water, and he meant to pass them by. Now I want you to get the story of what's going on. They cannot make any headway. These guys are the guys that are familiar with the Sea of Galilee. They cry out in fear if you read the rest of the story. They think they've seen a ghost. And the story says to us, Jesus made to just walk by them and just totally ignore them, just like this lady. But they kept crying to him, and he came toward them. When the hour was the darkest for Jacob, Esau sends word to him. He sends word first to Esau. He's coming home after 20 years. Esau sends word back in this manner. 400 armed men are coming. What's the last thing he heard from Esau's lips? 20 years ago, Esau said, I'll kill him. When Isaac dies, I'll kill him. She overheard it, his mother, Rebekah, so she gets Isaac to send him away. And for the next 20 years, they didn't know it was going to take that long that he never see Rebekah again, and Isaac would not see him for another 20 years. And now he returns with all these people and all these flocks and herds. And he divides his forces. I mean, he's thinking he's coming to kill us. And so he divides all of them into two camps. And he puts the maid servants and the women and their children in front, and then Leah and all of her children, and then finally his favorite wife, Rachel, and Joseph in the back, in one of the groups, hoping that the other one will be the most likely one to be struck. And then he sends out servants ahead, and they have these great numbers of animals, and then put a great distance between each of you. And when Esau arrives at one of you, you're to say, this is a present from your servant Jacob to my lord Esau. And he's trying to soften him up. And then it says he went down that deep Jabbok, if you've ever seen pictures of it, ravine, and he went to the other side and sat there by himself. Do you think he slept? And all of a sudden, doesn't it fascinate you how God reveals himself? How many different things in the Bible God tackles him in the middle of the night. What would you think if a man out of the blue, with all of what you've been thinking and all you've been preparing, you think somebody is a scout ahead, Esau sent a scout ahead, and this guy is attacking you now? Do you think they were just wrestling like brothers? Or do you think Jacob was trying to kill that guy? Well, maybe brothers do that too. And it says that when the man saw, he did not prevail against Jacob. He touched the socket of his hip, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And in 1 second, the whole thing turns. And then the strangest thing, the man says, let me go. Here's a man who's totally disabled. He's limping. If you ever watch those guys that wrestle, Olympic wrestling or your school or whatever, I mean, can you imagine if you disabled somebody in the hip? That guy's out. I mean, you can just push him over to the edge and get him out. Let me go, the man says, for the day has broken. Jacob says, I will not let you go unless you bless me. The lesser is always blessed by the greater. He said, what is your name? He said, Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Is that not a story of all men and women who wrestle with God. But we all do. It may not have come to you yet, but I guarantee you one day you will wrestle with God the same. You will be where that woman is. We all will be. And sooner or later, we will be, like Paul, perplexed. And we will shake our heads and wonder, do we just give up in despair? How hard she had tried in this life. How many tears she must have shed for her daughter. How many fruitless cures must she have sought, just as any parent would and does. My son was born way premature, 24 weeks. They barely could save him. All kinds of problems. Doctor, I remember telling us back then, if we can tackle one thing at a time, he has a chance to live. But there was always cerebral palsy that was staring you in the face because there may be too much oxygen. That's what happened to Tim Jennings' young son, Parker. The same thing had happened to my son. And then they had bleeding in their brain, and so hydrocephalus sets in, and you have to put shunts, and it's just one constant battle after another, after another, after another. I tell you, as a parent, you'll do anything. You'll seek anything. You'll grasp, if you must, at straws to find a solution for your child. And so must this woman. But the story tells us, as the psalmist says to us, it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. When we come to God, it is, as I said to you last night, that affliction that introduces us to who we really are, to ourselves. And so many times we're not going to like what we see. But without that affliction, as J.C. Ryle said in his commentary, without that affliction, she might have lived and died in careless ignorance and never seen Jesus at all. So the next time you think that the thing that is so horrible that's happened to your family, to your child, to you, to your parent, to your sibling, is so bad, remember that. Remember that if it had not come, you may never have sought God the way you should have. Prosperity doesn't drive us to God at all. Affliction will. God, this world, and you and me, finally, in this story, is a great lesson that the script has not been written in stone. Isn't it amazing that we can change the mind of God? Marvel that he listens to our prayers and answers. Calvinism would say in its purest form that God has decided everything. Everything you did today. The pure Calvinist would say, God ordained that. You only did according to the script that's already been written. I'm going to tell you, if that is so, then there's something that becomes very, very wrong about the fact that the Scripture says he can be greatly moved by faith. If he's orchestrated everything, he already knows how it's going to happen. Then he goes, oh, that's amazing. No. He says it's amazing because the script hasn't been written. And it marvels God when he sees people with great faith. Remember the centurion who said, I'm a man under authority. You don't have to come to my house. You speak the word because I have guys, I send soldiers out, I send servants out. When I tell them to do something, they do it. That's all you have to do. And Jesus, when he heard this, he marveled and said, to those who followed him, truly I tell you, I've not found in Israel such faith. Of the people that should have it. And he marvels at this woman. And he is greatly moved by faith. And if everything was orchestrated as the Calvinist said, then how could God marvel at anything? But he can marvel because it's not written in stone. So Jonathan looks at his armor bearer and says, are you with me? If they say come up to us, then we will know that God has delivered the Philistines into our hands. If they say stay, then we'll know. And he just went out on the greatest limb of faith. No word from God that God would do that. He just said, let's go. We got to do something. And how many times did people reach out and do the same thing, trusting God when they had no reason, it seemed, to do so. It's a great statement made to us in James, the 5th chapter and verse 11. And it says, "Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord." The New King James I like even better. It says, "You have seen the end intended by the Lord." How that the Lord is compassionate and merciful, or full of compassion, full of mercy. I'll tell you, when the end is all done, God will come in mercy. When the end is full and complete, God will come in compassion. If it's not in this life, it will be so in the other. But what He wants us to understand is, never let go of God. No matter how hard it is, keep the faith. That is why He said to this lady, "O woman, great is your faith." In October of 1864, after Sherman had taken Atlanta, he crossed the Chattahoochee to pursue Joseph Johnston's Confederates, who had withdrawn from Atlanta. John Bell Hood, the Texan, slipped behind Sherman's lines at his order, Johnston's order, intending to destroy the railroad and the main supply depot for the Union Army at Allatoona Pass. Sherman rushed Brigadier General John McCorse to intercept Hood. Barely arriving with half of his division, only 2,000 men, McCorse immediately faced a superior force of 3,000 Confederates under Samuel G. French. French gave Corse 5 minutes to unconditionally surrender and, quote, "avoid a needless effusion of blood." Corse shot back his terse reply, "We are prepared for the needless effusion of blood whenever it is agreeable to you." And with that, the battle commenced. It was a savage engagement. Both sides lost heavily. The Union lost 1/3 of its men in a matter of minutes. 2 out of 3 of the redoubts fell to the Confederates. But Corse held the last one firm, even himself being shot through his cheek and his ear, a scar that he would bear the rest of his life. And the Confederates withdrew at 4 in the afternoon. Because Sherman had signaled him that morning from the top of Kennesaw Mountain, "Hold fast, we are coming." 60,000 federal troops were coming from all different directions to their aid. And so McCorse never was able to accomplish, nor the Confederates, what they intended. There was a song that was written in the hymnals of the day after that. No one knows quite what Sherman did say. Did he say, "Hold fast," or "Hold the fort"? So there's an old song that says, "Hold the fort." But I like "Hold fast, we are coming." Almost the last words in the New Testament are Jesus saying, "I am coming. I am coming. Hold fast." Whatever we face in this life, hold fast. He is coming. If you're subject to heaven's invitation this night, Jesus said, "He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned." And if we can help you tonight to come to Him, while together we stand and while we sing.